Who were the principal Beach Boys during the period when you were active in the club?
Oh, I can remember them so well. You know, there are a lot of Beach Boys that everybody hears about, you know. Everybody remembers Chick.
Yeah.
And Panama.
Oh, yes.
And Sally Hale. Of course, people remember Sally Hale. And all of the Kahanamo Groups.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other Beach Boys like Typhoon Spencer. You remember Typhoon Spencer?
Vaguely. No, I don't remember too well.
Typhoon Spencer was a Park Hawaiian guy who had lived in Maine for many years. And he came back here in the early 30s and went to work for the Beach Patrol. That was Typhoon Spencer. And then there was Frank Tellis,
mm-hmm.
Curly Cornwall.
Oh, Curly, yeah.
Laughing John.
Yeah.
Pua Ke Aloha. Of course, Harry Rubello and Turkey and
Steamboat.
Now I'm talking about, started off with the guys around the outbreak, and then down at the Huinalo side, of course, there was John D. Calpico and Joe Guerrero and Joe Kana and Charlie Amaru. And I used to go over and play volleyball at the Huinalo. They had a volleyball court that they set up next to the Moan Hotel, just near the Joe Fats lunch stand that was right there on the beach.
Was that the headquarters, Huinalo?
The Huinalo bathhouse was, Huinalo so-called clubhouse, mm-hmm. was the Moana Hotel bathhouse.
Ah.
They didn't have a club of their own, per se, but that's where they hung out, that's where they kept their stuff over. And I used to go over and play volleyball with them. They had a fishnet strung between a couple of ironwood trees. And if you contributed 10 cents to the ball, you could go over there and play, you know. So I used to go and play with the Huinalo guys. And they had a guy named Brady Karate, who had been a Firebird top-notch volleyball player. And so I used to go over there. I used to like to play against Brady because I learned a lot of volleyball just playing with him. And then the other people, now they, Steamboat's dad. Remember Steamboat's dad?
Mm-hmm.
And you remember Haile Selassie, the Beach Boy?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot. You know, I don't think anybody's mentioned his name in any of these interviews.
Haile Selassie was no Hawaiian, but he was sure black. But he could play the ukulele. Remember, he could play Nola on the ukulele. In those days, that was a big thing. There was no Ota-san in those days, you know. And you remember Frank Tellis? Mm-hmm. Trick he used to do?
Frank
Tellis, the Beach Boy?
Yep.
You remember the trick?
No.
Oh, well, this is great. Panama Dave, you know what an operator he was. Well, we'd set up some tourists. Some tourists would be sitting under the beach umbrella in front of the Royal Hawaiian seawall, and we'd start the conversation going, and we'd get into athletics, you know. And then finally, after we got the people all primed, we said, well, we got a guy right here. He says, you see this this sidewalk up here above the seawall? And you see that steel picket fence with the spikes on top? And you notice that the sidewalk is about 5 feet higher than the sand down the other side? Well, this friend of ours can run along the sidewalk, dive over this picket fence, clear the sidewalk, and down onto the sand and land on his head. We set the people up. And, impossible. So Panama would make them bet, you see. He'd set them up for about 4 or 5 scotch and sodas. So I'd be in on it. So we set them up for 6 scotch and sodas, 3 for me and 3 for Panama. Frank got nothing. So we get Frank Tellis to do it. Well, Frank Tellis, in the old days, high jumping, you had to go over feet first. Well, Frank Tellis did waterless high diving. He could dive over the bar higher than the guys could high jump. But in those days, that was illegal. It's legal now. So we get Frank. The sidewalk above the seawall, he'd run along the sidewalk, dive head first, clear this picket steel fence, clear the sidewalk down below, land on the sand, and do a roll. That head first and do a roll and just pop to his feet like this. Panama knocked like six cushions. Frank didn't drink.
Didn't pay him off at all.
Oh, Joe Minor. Did anybody talk about Joe Minor? Oh, Joe Minor. Joe Minor was the beach attendant for the Aubrey Canoe Club and the Royal Hawaiian. And he had all of the beach umbrellas. And Joe had a room in the basement of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel where he kept all of his gear, his umbrellas and chairs and stuff. And in there, he had his spare sawhorses with a surfboard on where he gave lomi lomis. So he'd take these gals in there and lock the door and give them a lomi lomi.
Oh, the story.
Oh, yeah.
About the Beach Boys and the
gals. Oh, yeah. So he said, well, I got the key anytime you want to use it.
They got you on tape now, this.
He was quite a character. Oh, no, Sam Poi Poi was one of the guys around the club.
He was the past president of the club?
No, I don't think he was the president. I don't know if he was president. I don't remember.
I think so.
Yeah?
Of course, Tom Singleton was for many years the treasurer of the club.
This oh, yeah. Period in the Sam club. Fuller, I know.
Sam Fuller, that's
right. It was Sam Poi Poi, not
Sam Poi Poi.
Sam Fuller was around. We played volleyball. Oh, and we used to play volleyball, and we'd play big games, six on the side. And when I was a young guy, I had all of these old guys who played. Ernest Tucker Chase,
yes.
Admiral Tulloch, Alfred Young Nickel, Ernest Stenberg, all these guys. And oh, Brother Chase always wanted to win, you know. This is what he always wanted to do. So we'd take winners. There'd be two six-man teams. This is after work, all the businessmen came out. There'd be two six-man teams. Okay, we got the winners. So Tucker Chase, he wants to organize his team to take them on. So he'd recruit me and, you know, a couple of other young guys. And then we'd get on there, and we had more damn fun. And then we had this, we had these intra-club tournaments, six-man tournaments. And so I was usually the captain of one team, and Duke would be a captain, you know, these. And then we'd draw lots to see who we'd get. And I remember one team I had Joe Farrington, Lauren Thurston, and Ingram Steinbeck.
Steinbeck? Really?
The old governor. I had these three guys on my team. I'll never forget that. That was a lot of fun.
That Joe Franken, he was the president of the club.
Yeah. Well, he was a tremendous guy, that Joe Franken.
Yeah.
He was a big guy. During the war, he came to Okinawa during the campaign. He came to the camp to see us.
Really?
Yeah.
What about the social activities at the club in those days?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. Now, we're talking about the old club. I'm talking about the 30s, before we had that.
This is
before you built the new old club. Yeah. I'm talking about the old
club. Make it that time.
The old club I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Well, we had on the beach between the Royal and the Monarch, right next to the Royal, we had a one-story canoe shed, corrugated iron shed, where we kept all the canoes. In the Eva Mackay corner, was the beach patrol office where the Beach Boys worked on. Mm-hmm. On the Diamond Head end, there was a little lanai with the chairs on it where the old ladies could go out and sit and, you know, watch the people on the beach. And we had the big clock. The big clock was right up there. And then back of that, there was the Howl Tree Terrace. And there was a little sort of a lanai up in the middle of the trees, up above, in the trees, where you could look over the canoe shed out in the water. And then down below, in back, was the snack bar. May had her little snack bar in there. And there was a little club kitchen, and there were benches and tables underneath.
You've got an amazing memory.
Yeah. And in back of that building was where we made the surfboards. There was a little shed in back of that building where we made the surfboards. And then, then between the snack, then along the boundary, along the Moana side, boundary of all the surfboard lines, from the beach all the way up to the locker room. Now, between the snack bar and the locker room, where we had three volleyball courts, one little court and two full-size courts. And then came the locker room, which was a two-story building that had previously been on the beach. It had been moved back there. Underneath were the men's and women's locker rooms. Upstairs was a dance pavilion, where we had the club dance suite. And then between there and the road was our parking lot, which is a dirt parking lot. So that's what we had for the club. Now, talk about social life. In those days, there was no bar in the club. This was
prohibition?
Well,
the prohibition was still in 33.
Well, it started in when repeal came in. Remember, Franklin Roosevelt started off with 3.2 beer.
I sure you do.
Yeah. And then hard liquor came. But the club didn't have any. Before we had the club, before this one, there was no booze on the premises at all. Well, this volleyball playing gang was kind of like to drink beer, you see.
But volleyball came without bringing blue club, yeah. Didn't like to drink beer.
So we, all my gang, all the volleyball players, we had our own rule. On Saturdays, people worked till noon on Saturdays, those days. You came to the club, and you couldn't drink water. No fair drinking water. And we'd get out and play volleyball all afternoon in that blazing sun on the hot sand without water. And then finally, about 5 o'clock or so, you'd hear somebody stick his head out of the window at the locker room and yell, They are. Okay, that was the signal. So everybody quit playing volleyball, go in and take a shower and change, pile into some cars and go down the old palm tree inn.
Oh my.
Go to the palm tree inn.
Here do.
Well, then we had our own table there. There was this huge round table where we went in.
That used to be called the Poor Man's Pacific.
Poor Man's Pacific Club. That became the Poor Man's Pacific Clubs. Later,
yeah.
This place had class, and beer was 10 cents a glass, you know,
yeah.
And you could stack drinks. Well, after we got through playing volleyball, we'd go down there and start tuning up on a few beers. And we'd fill that table with beers, and we'd sit around and tell tall tales. And Saturday night, now this is Saturday night, then we'd adjourn to the Kehlani Boat Club downtown.
Yes.
The old Rat's Killer. So we'd all go down there, we'd go into the Rat's Killer, which was a beer joint, and we'd spend the rest of the night there. That was a jumping place. You remember that?
I remember the rest.
Oh, yes, so that was the extent of the social life as far as we were concerned. Of course, the old ladies brought their picnic lunches down there, and they'd have cook a little heck of dinner in the club kitchen. Well, that was in our bag in this place.
Well, then you've seen the club from that particular building and layout through the construction of the new old club.
Yeah,
that was right about what he was.
1940, I think, just before the war. Mm-hmm.
Walter Mack.
Walter McFarlane, he was a driving force between that man and Putin.
What was your recollection of the construction of that building, the things that took place at that particular time?
Well, I don't really remember too much about the construction. I don't remember too much. But speaking about Walter Mack, now there was a tremendous guy. I knew Walter Mack for many, many years.
Yes.
And he used to date my sister Nina before Nina got married.
See, really?
Bill Wise and Walter McFarlane were rivals, and Bill won, of course. Well, I got to know Walter Mack quite well. But this is what happened, isn't it? But I think about Walter Mack brings to mind this story. We were out sailing. Those days, we had sailing canoes that we don't see much around here.
No.
And so this one Sunday afternoon, Dad Setter and I and a couple of guys were sailing this canoe off Waikiki. We're about 2 miles out to sea, sailing along this beautiful And we see this guy swimming.
Jesus, it's a long ways from shore.
And we come, where's Walter Mack? What the hell are you doing out there? So we hauled him on board. So what are you doing out in the middle of the ocean?
Oh, he said, I was on party on this yacht. I got tired of it. I said, the hell with this, I'm going home. He already been swimming for 1 mile when we saw him. I'll never forget that. Nothing to him, just to swim in.
Well, the club sure owes him a debt of destruction. But he really kept the club together in those days.
Oh, yes, he did.
Tom Singlehurst was there.
Tom Singlehurst. And Wilford Godbold.
Wilford,
yes, he really worked for this.
Wilford's the one that got us that beautiful lace on this property.
He
did a magnificent job.
He really worked for it. Getting back to Walter Mack, though, when I was a young guy, my heroes were a bunch of young men about town, not too young men. That was Walter Mack's gang, composed of Duke Hanamuku, Kalakaua Kawana Nakoa,
Cook,
and Bill Hollinger.
Bill
Hollinger.
Oh, yes.
Those were the big boys. And they used to operate, and they had all the women, and they did all the things that we young guys hoped that we could do. But we learned a lot from them.
Well, Walter Mack was a good cook, was a good teacher.
Oh, yeah. I tell you, the guy I learned a lot from was Jack McKenzie, too.
He was a colorful guy.
Oh, he was something else.
Well, Jack and the Hollingers. You mentioned Duke. What's your recollection of
Duke?
And his brother, so.
Oh, well, I tell you, Duke and I were very, very good friends. Duke liked me when I was just a teenager because he liked the way I surfed. We used to surf together a lot. And when I was 18 years old, I was the only kid in the club who could use any of Duke's surfboards anytime.
Really?
Yeah. He told me anytime, we had half a dozen boards. You know, the thing I remember about Duke was his uncanny knowledge of the ocean at Waikiki. It was really spooky. And I learned, after surfing with him a few years, I caught on. We'd be sitting out a canoe surf, first break, right in that area. And we'd be sitting there waiting for a wave, you know, a bunch of people. And I'd keep my eye on Duke. And the ocean could be absolutely calm. All of a sudden, he'd head out to sea. See? I head out right behind him, because we'd go out, say, a couple of hundred feet, and by the time we got there, a huge set of waves coming in. There was absolutely no indication, but he knew, so I just followed him. And he, I, the only two guys out there, we catch a wave and go right through the whole pack. So he knew the currents and the wind and the surf. Let me tell you a story about Duke. The year was 1934. And we had the biggest surf I had ever seen before or since in Waikiki. So we went out to Castle Surf. Huge surf. Oh. So we were out there. Duke was out there on his big board. I was there on my 13-foot hollow board. And I remember Suckwind Vieira was there.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Hurd. Jimmy Hurd. You know the Hurd brothers from
football? Oh, yeah, Jimmy and Alan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jimmy was there, and Lex and a few other guys, and it was the waves were absolutely terrifying. Well, then there was a lull, and so we kind of moved in, and then Duke said, look at that, and we looked outside, and this huge set of waves coming in, and we started paddling out as fast as we could. We couldn't make it. I came to a wave almost to break, and I paddled up the forward slope, just about in a vertical position, and that thing broke, and it just knocked me tail over tea kettle, took my board, and everyone lost his board. Duke lost his board, the big board. And then the waves kept coming, and we had to dive under, and I was running out of breath, and I dived on the wave, and I come up, and the foam was so thick, the foam was about 4 inches thick, and you had to
stick your nose above the foam before you could breathe. And I was just about, I just about ready to give up. And then the last wave. And then, so I started swimming in. And I swam in, and I come across Duke's board. My board, no, we're excited. So I get on Duke's board, and I paddle out to give the board to Duke. Duke said, well, I'll take you in to get your board, Waller. I said, no, I'll swim in. He said, sure, I'll take you in. I said, no, I'll swim. So I started swimming in. And it was late. It was getting late in the afternoon. It was getting dark. So I swim in, and boy, long swim, half a mile swim to the old seawall. You had to go around the reef outside the belly pad. And it's dark, and I'm by myself, and these huge waves are knocking me all over the place. Oh, Sam Kahanamoku was with us that day, talked it to me. And Bill Haynes.
Bill Haynes. Oh, Bill? Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So, finally I get into shore, and it's nighttime. I get up on the seawall. My board nowhere to be seen. So I start running along the seawall towards Diamond Head, you know, where Queen's Beach is.
Yeah.
And there are some houses over there. And I go along and I see my board. My board is about 100 feet offshore, semi-submerged in the shallow water. I climbed up a telephone pole so I could see it. So I wait out there and I get my board, and it came over the reef, and a hole is stoked in the bottom. And
water.
Full of water. So I drag it up on the beach and let the water out. Okay, so I got this board, 68 pounds, is a lot of weight to carry all the way back to the elevator club. I can't paddle it back. So I go in the house and I phone my sister. She comes down with a car. I put the board on the roof of the car, and I get back to the club. I put the board in the locker and I walk into the club. Well, by this time, it's about, 7 o'clock at night. I walk into the locker room.
Everybody wondering where they are.
I walk in, the guys look at me, they jump up and down and start screaming and clapping me on the back. Father! Duke and Sam and Bull Haynes and these guys, they've been sitting around wondering where I was. It's all my clothes in the locker. You know, now my board wasn't there, and it was dark, pitch black. They can't go out to get me, and they were sitting around there trying to figure out what to do when I walked in the door.
No ghost guide or helicopters in those days.
They looked like they saw a ghost when I walked in the door. Well, I never had people so happy to see me in my life. Oh, I'll never forget that. Now we can tell surfing stories forever.
I imagine so.
Well, what was your... You've seen a lot of changes from the old club and coming down here to the new club. What do you think of the new club?
Well, I like it. You know, you get too many old timers who long for the old days, you know? I say, the biggest shortcoming as far as this club is concerned, the surf is no damn good around here, except when Castle or Public Baths breaks. That's the bad part. Other than that, it's all good. But it's also away from the action. Where we were before, we were right in the middle of Waikiki. You know?
But considering what's happened to Waikiki, I think it's probably a godsend that we moved out here, because you had been hemmed in all by the hotels and
blocked now, identity. Now it looks good, this location. This is the right move.
Yeah. How much do you use the club now?
Well, I live over on the volcano in Hawaii.
Oh, yeah, but you didn't move over there until...
How long did you
live?
Oh, I've only been there a year now.
About a year.
Yeah.
How often do you get to town?
Oh, I get here about once a month.
I know, but before you moved over there, you were always here almost every morning having a workout.
Before we moved there, I lived at 1350 Ala Moana.
Ah.
And so I came here Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings to work out. And so we use the club quite a lot. But now that I'm a senior member, the dues aren't too bad, so I keep my membership while I'm living around Hawaii.
Enjoy the volcano?
You what?
You enjoying the volcano?
Oh, I love it.
I love that place.
Oh, that was. But my wife Yvonne is not too crazy about it, because the social action is not terrific over there. But if you want peace and quiet, you've got it. and it's cool and just.
Well, you keep yourself in beautiful shape. You look, you can see the change in the last 15 years.
Well, you know, when you get to be an old man, you have to hang on to what little you have left. You got to work for it.
Well, no, this has been just fantastic. Is there anything else you can think of, anecdotes or any comments you'd like to make for the record?
Oh, well, yeah. I have to say something about Dad Center.
Oh, please.
Dad Center was one of my dearest friends. Dad was older than me, but he was our gang.
Sure was. Yeah.
And we used to go drink beer. And then one year, Dad coached the Outrigger Canoe Club volleyball team. And that's when the Rathskeller was in operation. So we'd practice at night at the old Army-Navy YMCA downtown. Well, and then we go to the Rathskeller after practice. Well, the practices got shorter and shorter.
The Rathskeller sessions got longer and longer.
Oh, gosh. And, Dad, in my younger days, at the old club, Dad, we'd go fishing with Dad's son. He had an outboard motor on an Outrigger canoe. And Wilbur Craw and Lex Brody were great fishermen. Dad taught them how to do all this stuff. And we'd come down here early in the morning and get all the gear. And then we'd go trolling for, we'd get mostly Cavalier. And we'd go along the shore all the way down to Pearl Harbor and back and catch all of this fish. Oh, we had a great time. And then Dad and his girlfriend at the time and my wife and I, we used to go to picnics out at Makaha and Miley Beach and...
I have some wonderful recollections of that. Dad was my swimming coach. I was swimming team at Punahou. My junior. Then he left my junior and filled me out.
Oh, yeah.
When I coached my senior year. But Dad and I had some wonderful times together. We used to go to Francis Brown's place at Cabbage.
Oh, yeah. Remember Dad's old place here at Diamond Head?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We used to go out there.
So if I ask you, did you do much manual paddling?
No, I only paddled for 1 year. I was surfing and volleyball.
Yeah, surfing and volleyball. Of course, you know, paddling didn't come back into the forefront until relatively recently. As a matter of fact, I can remember the 19th, I think it was July 1933, when they had the reestablished...
Oh, I'll never forget that. I was there.
Oh, you were?
Oh, boy.
So was I. But tell me about your
experience. Okay, 1933, they revived the Outrigger canoe races. And the races were held that year at Napo'opo over in Kona. And I remember the Outrigger, the senior crew, Toots Menville was struck. And they had Clarence Ritchie, Wilbur Craw, Lex Brody, and Small Cook was steering. Somebody else in there. Mm-hmm. Did I miss anybody? And then the junior crew were the two Birkins and Herbie Jordan and Campbell Stevenson and Dick Beckert was steering. Anyway, we got over there to Napo'opo. I was 19 years old. Well, we had the Bowman family place up at Captain Cook. It's a big old house. So all the Bowmans went over there for the canoe races. And so we were down at the beach and saw the races. After the races, the Outrigger ones, Dad Center was a coach. So, and Dad had a little tent set up there on the beach. After the races, he comes out with a gallon of Old Coley House slung over his elbow, you know?
Yeah.
And a couple of glasses. Those days I didn't drink, but there was a pretty good party going in. And then we took all these people up, friends of ours, up to our place at Captain Cook. And God, we had a dozen people stay overnight at our place. And then had a dance down at the Coley Inn. You remember that?
I remember that because the Hula Lai, I guess it was just outside waiting to be made. And they're waiting for steamboat.
Yeah.
And they're chicken. Derek was dancing, and they finally had to sell the boat in and get him in Kentucky, drag him out to get, so they could leave. I had to stay. I was just a kid at the time, and I was staying with the Charles right across the street. And also we went up at the Andre Noy walls with Julie Richardson. Anyway, I had no way to get back to Honolulu. The next day, the Itasca. African group had come over on Itasca. And Dad took pity on me and said, come aboard. So that's the way I got back to Honolulu. It was too bad that particular day.
And speaking of that, that dance at the Kona Inn after the races, you know, my father was a very handsome man. And
yes, indeed.
Quite a guy with the ladies. Well, let's see. Dad was, my father was at the dance, and he saw, we'd spent a lot of time in Kona. We had a place over there. Dad saw this elderly Hawaiian woman that he had known for years and years, full-blooded Hawaiian. And Dad, my dad, the courtly gentleman, you know, he has to go over and ask her for a dance. So he takes her on the dance floor and goes a few steps, and she looks deep into his eyes, and she says, Bowman, you still got that old electricity.
You're speaking about the Bowman place that Captain Cook, because I remember it was almost adjacent to the Yates.
Right next door.
Right next door to the Yates.
It had belonged to the senior Yates, my mother's parents. That
so well, how come you folks had that place there? So to your mother, and you kept it for years?
Yeah, my mother's parents lived in that house. Then my uncle Julian built a house right next door, so the Julian Yates lived next door. Then when my grandparents died, they left the house to my mother.
I see.
Then when my mother died, she left the house to us.
Is it still there?
Still there.
It's still. I know it's the Bowman. Everybody refers to it as the Bowman House.
Well, you know, there was a. We had 3.5 acres of property there. All the property has been subdivided into little house lots, and now this big old place is stuck in the middle of these little new houses. Yeah, but I can still find it. That house is all redwood. It's in perfect shape.
Do you know that Julian Yates is responsible for my dad going to Hawaii?
No.
Yeah. My dad has been practicing law in Honolulu with Frank Thompson, and they represented Parker Ranch.
Uh-huh.
So he went up to Hilo a couple of times and won a few cases for Parker Ranch in Hilo. Got to meet Julian and A.W. Carter.
Yeah.
And so finally one day they said to him, we need another lawyer in Hilo. We got Carl Carlsberg, and need a little competition. So they prevailed my dad to move to Hilo.
Oh!
And I set up a law firm there.
Oh.
And of course, one of his staunchest political supporter and mine is Julian Yates.
I kind of forgot about your political career. You know?
The Yates family,
the Yates family alone is enough to elect you.
Well, you know, this is a good thing. And I didn't really realize what was happening, but Archie, you know, be running married Archie. Well, Archie was Julian was chairman of the Hawaiian Host Commission at that time. Now, just later, he was on Hawaii when I first ran. The word came down. All the Kaawas, the Honolulu, all the Kaawas and all the Yates were out campaigning for me. I always remember that. People I didn't know.
I remember voting for you.
Yeah, thanks. So you probably had a. Well, of course, you were working government at that time. You couldn't have a sticker on your car. But there were many that did. Oh, those were wonderful days.
You know, speaking about working for the government, after people knew me as a surfer interested in big waves, I'd be working at the office, and I'd get a phone call. This happened often. Hey, first break, why aren't you down here? You know, I'm working. Everybody felt that the big surf was it. I was supposed to be there.
Bowman had to be there. Yeah. Oh, well, there's anything else you can think of.
God, I think I've spoken too much already.
Oh, no, this has been absolutely delightful. I think this is, as far as I'm concerned, I think this is one of the best interviews you've had yet. You know, you have such a fantastic recollection of people and events, places, and times. Well, let's consider this as the first step. If anything comes to your mind that you want to have another interview, just call me, because I've enjoyed every minute.
Well, if I can remember all that stuff, I don't have Alzheimer's yet.
sometimes think I'm a candidate. Amen. Thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome.
Just for the present.
Great.
Hey, man, we forgot to talk about your family. Tell me about your youngsters.
Well, I have three children. Bonnie, the daughter, is oldest, and then there's Bruce, and then there's Brent. Now, Bonnie and Bruce graduated from the University of Hawaii. Bonnie in education, and Bruce in travel industry management. The younger boy, Brent, graduated from the University of Denver. Bonnie lives in Portland. She's married and teaches school. And our son, Bruce, lives in Portland. He's been in the restaurant business in Portland. And our son, Brent, lives at Popaiku'u over on the island of Hawaii. He works for the Gila Coast Processing Sugar Plantation. That's about it.
Any more for them?
Oh, my older son, Bruce, has one son, Eric, who's now 15.
15.
He lives in Chicago. They're divorced. He lives in Chicago. Our son, Brent, over at Popaiku'u, has three boys. They're about 12, 9, and 6. And their names are... The oldest one is Kiavi, the next one is Keoni, and the youngest is Kavika.
Ah,
those three Hawaiian names, and there's one is a blonde and the other two are redheads.
Really?
Well, that's fun.
So that's about it for the kids. Thank you again very, very much.